I'm Raphael.
I'm Kirk.
And this is the housing problem. In previous episodes of this podcast, and please do catch up now at thehousingproblem.com, we've spoken with lawmakers, housing policymakers, advocates, developers, authors, and other leaders in the housing space.
So, Raphael, we've had some amazing guests this season so far.
Yeah, we really have. It's been a dream lineup, giving us both national perspective, but also focusing in on our backyard and keeping our eye on New York City. It's been a great season so far.
Absolutely. But I got to say, I think our guest today may have the most interesting story of any of our guests so far. I mean, at a minimum, he's in the running, and I don't want to put too much pressure on him now.
That's great. Nice. Well, so much for managing expectations. You know, I generally like to under-promise and over-deliver, but I guess that ship has sailed. So our guest better be ready to wow everybody. But let's get into it. I'm Raphael Sestero. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of the Community Preservation Corporation. I've been in the affordable housing world in New York City for over 30 years, and I also spent time as the commissioner of the Department of Housing Preservation and Development.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. I'm president of Monadnock Development, also been in affordable housing over 30 years, and I'm passionate about solving the housing problem.
Together, Kirk and I have over 60 years of experience in housing in New York City and around the country. We both care deeply about neighborhoods and about the people that we serve in those communities.
One thing inevitably is going to come up over and over again when we're talking about the housing problem, particularly in urban areas like New York City, is the disproportionate impact it has on people of color. And it's just really difficult to have a discussion about housing without touching on race, given how deeply racism is ingrained historically in housing policy.
Yeah, I mean, the basic foundation of our nation's housing policy is founded in redlining, in building single family homes in neighborhoods that were zoned only for single family homes that wouldn't allow people of color to buy the homes. People of color couldn't get access to the mortgages. And there have been just so many tools that have been used for so long to keep communities segregated, to keep certain groups of people from accessing the opportunities that have been available to others.
And I think when you look at the differential in home ownership rates between people of color and white homeowners, you start to see some of the evidence of, you know, historic policies that were discriminatory. And there was a report by the National Association of Realtors that found that home ownership rates for white Americans in 2021 was about 72%, while the home ownership rate for Black Americans was just 44%. But another way this plays out that's often overlooked is Black representation among the folks who are developers and actually building and owning properties, commercial properties in the United States.
Yeah, Kirk, we've talked about this many times on the podcast. It's truly unbelievable. And, you know, I was looking into the numbers on this, and it's really staggering. According to a recent reporting by the New York Times, there are 112,000 real estate development firms in the United States. And do you know how many of them are owned by people of color? It's a crazy number, just 1,000 or less than 1%.
Hey, Raphael, I wish I could say I'm surprised, but I'm not. But fortunately, today we have a great guest who I think is going to help us shed some light on not only why it's so difficult as a person of color to break into the real estate development field, but why that representation matters to the housing problem and housing solutions overall. So let's get into it.
Yeah, man, I've been really looking forward to this one. You and I have been talking about it for a while. There are people that you meet, you know, when you get into this business and you're inspired by their story, you're inspired by what they've accomplished in their lives and their vision for what they want to do with their business and what that business and the impact that business can have in communities. And our guest today is one of those people. His name is Jamar Adams. He's the managing principal of Essence Development, a firm he founded in 2021. Prior to starting his own firm, Jamar was vice president of development in New York at the Related Companies. He has developed projects not just in New York, but all over the country. He's a member of the advisory council for the Fund for Public Housing. You know, he went to this little school in the Midwest that has funny color. One of the colors' name is funny. It looks like yellow, but it's maize. They did something really important this year. So I think Jamar's having a pretty good year this year. I'm not entirely sure, but I think so far he's been having a pretty good year because his Michigan Wolverines won the national championship. But the reason why that's so important to Jamar is not just because he went to Michigan, but he played football for 4 years at Michigan. And then he played in the NFL with the Seattle Seahawks and the Philadelphia Eagles. Our listener can't see it, but Jamar just put on his Michigan helmet. And so Kirk said the other day to me, Jamar, you just said no. He said to me the other day that always found that people with elite athletic talent were really, really good at real estate development. And at first I thought he was talking about me.
Definitely.
And then I thought he was talking about himself. And I thought, he can't be talking about himself. But then I realized he was talking about you and some others that we know who also. But it's the attention to detail. It's the commitment to purpose. And so we're really excited to have you here, Jamar, and welcome to The Housing Problem, my friend.
Thank you, Raphael. Thank you, Kurt. Thank you to your audience for having me here. Listened a few times. You guys have a great show, great content, and talking about a really important problem, which is housing, not only in New York City, not only in New York State, but across the country. So glad to be here.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Absolutely. So we always start with each of our guests, giving them an opportunity to talk about their personal journey and how they made it into the particular field they're in. Specifically, in your case, it's becoming a real estate developer with a focus on affordable housing. And, you know, we're excited to hear about how you started your life and also, as Raphael alluded to, your journey through sports and athletics that has led you to a place where not many people with your background make it. It's really extraordinary trajectory. So, Jamar, give us some insight into, you know, how you grew up, where you grew up, and how you got to where you are right now.
Thanks, Curry. It's an interesting story. It's interesting when even I think back on it. So originally from Charlotte, North Carolina, youngest son to a single mother. I have two older brothers. One's 10 years older, one's 5 years older. You know, when I was growing up, in 1991, I was six. I saw my first dead body. My brother's dad was killed. Definitely was a kind of a traumatic, you know, time for me in a period. I mean, a six-year-old seeing a dead body was very traumatic. But that was kind of unfortunately the norm. I was sharing with someone the other day. I said we would get shot at, and the irony of it was that we would run, we would get somewhere safe, and me and my friends or me and my cousins wouldn't get there and say, "Yo, man, that was crazy." Like, well, we would laugh at each other, like, "You look scared when we were running." Like, you know, you I knew you were scared. I saw you, right? And it was just the energy of the neighborhood and the culture. And so, But I saw other people going to jail. I saw other people getting shot and killed. And I knew that wasn't a track for me. And so I was really small and for a long time, but I was athletic. And not until I was about 12, I started playing football. Always played basketball, started playing football and running track. And it was great for me because not growing up with a dad, I had all these great male figures around. And so, you know, football kind of started becoming a sport I was much better at than the others. It was a football and track. Then it became football. Got my first offer as a freshman in high school to University of Tennessee. I hated them. So I was like, this is a waste of energy for them. But actually got my second or third offer was the University of Michigan when I was a freshman. And I kind of always looked towards them because, you know, that brand was always rich. That color of maize was always amazing. Ended up going to University of Michigan. But when I was there, I always had a vision, like, I'm gonna be a businessman, I'll play in the NFL. But I had a professor, a black professor, who used to challenge me. I had 18 credits during the season, and he's always say, he challenged me, "I want you to do more work, do more work." So one of the things first thing he said was, "Do you know what your name means?" And I'm like, "What does that have to do with anything?" find out what your name means that will start to give you guidance of who you are. So I went and did a research project, found out what my name meant. So Jamar means beautiful. My middle name, Dontavious, is the eighth world leader, and Adams is man of the earth. So I had to write a paper on that. He was like, all right, so now you can start to understand who you are. Now you need to figure out like what you're going to do in life. Mm. And so I want you to read the current affairs every day, write me a 500 word paper on, you know, like what you said, Red, it was interesting. So first 2 weeks, don't even remember what I wrote about. I wrote something. The third week, this was 2006, Blackstone had gone public or was about to go public. And the article was about Steven Schwarzman having $1 billion, $1.2 billion bonus that he was going to take that year. And he started the company with $485,000 with Pete Peterson. And to me, a young black kid, 21 years old, about to go to the NFL, where I think my rookie year base pay was like $350,000. I'm doing the math. I'm like, if I play a few years, I should have that 485. I think I can get into this private equity game. And so it really shifted my mind and started saying, you know, when football is over, because it's going to end, I want to be in private equity or hedge funds. So when I went to play football, on the Tuesdays we had off, I played for the Seahawks and the Eagles. We'd have Tuesdays off during the season. And I would take those Tuesdays and I would go to investment banks and I would just job shadow with these guys. And everyone would love for me to be in there. And I would get to go sit with like the president of the company, because it was like I literally just played on Sunday. Right. They watched the game. And then they're like, oh, this guy's sitting in my office. And so I had to give him like 15 minutes of, oh, man, it was, and when I hit that guy, my neck was hurting, or I can't believe that guy made that catch. But the rest of the day was then about business, about where they went to school, what they studied, like what are they doing? Like, how are they investing? What are their strategies? And I kind of enhanced the experience because I was reading books and I would ask questions that I thought was kind of informed questions, because I'm like reading these books. And so what happened was, when I got injured, I cracked two vertebrae in my neck and severely herniated three discs in my back. At Jet Stadium, my last game was at MetLife. They called me and was like, a couple of guys called me and was like, what are you doing? I haven't seen you play this year. And I was like, no, I'm injured. You know, right now the doctors are telling me it's probably not a great idea if I return. And they were like, you should come work for us. We would love for you to come work for us. And so offers from investment banks, final offer from Goldman Sachs, because I wanted to work there. I was like, I went to the best college, Michigan, played in the best league, NFL. I want to go to the best investment bank. So, and no offense to anyone who worked anywhere else, but that was my perception at that time. Went to, so I interviewed, they offered me. I was going to start 3 weeks later, and I had a vision. Goldman, go get my executive MBA from the business school of the University of Michigan. It's called the Ross School of Business. And I was at a golf tournament. A guy was like, guy by the name of Dave Pearson, who played at the University of Michigan and worked at the related companies at the time. He's like, hey, Matt, you got a great story. You got great energy. Like, I want to introduce you to Steven. I think he can help you with like that letter of recommendation to go to Ross School. I came in to meet Mr. Ross on a Monday. The best part of the story is that all my clothes were being shipped to to Chicago, where I was going to be working at Goldman. So I had like some jeans on, like a collared shirt, but it wasn't tucked in because I didn't have a belt. So I had to flip the pants up on the back of the pant. You know. And Dave like meets me at this Starbucks. We actually like, there was two Starbucks very close. So I went to the wrong Starbucks. And he's like, man, where you at? Man, I was like, I'm here. And he's like, no, you wait. So finally connected with him. And he's like, what are you? You don't have a suit on. I was like, nah, my suits and stuff are like going to like Chicago. Like, I got a collar shirt on. He's like, man, Steve is like very formal guy. He's like suit, coat and tie. Like, and so he gives me his jacket. But for those who don't know Dave Pearson plays center at the University of Michigan. He was like 315. Okay. So the jacket I was swimming in, I got on like Vans and like some jeans, and I like, you know, I got to tuck my shirt in because you couldn't see the fold up in the back because the jacket was hanging down. I go to sit to talk to Steven Rawson. So my energy didn't feel like great, but, you know, he saw through all of that, and the conversation would be 15 minutes. Ended up being, I stayed there for like 5 hours. He introduced me to Jeff Blau. He introduced me to Bruce Beal, Justin Metz, Dan Fullup, who, may he rest in peace, who passed away. So Dan was a Goldman alum. Metz was a Goldman alum. Blau went to Michigan. Right. And so there was all this connection. And then Steven was like, listen, you will do great in real estate. He was like, you will do great here. And he's like, I think it'll be better for you to come work here. Well, we will mentor you. Real estate is an apprenticeship type business. We will mentor you and you will grow. You go to Goldman, you'll be like one of 80,000. Hmm. You'll be here. You'll be somebody special that we can help grow. And he was a man of his word. I worked at Related for about a decade. Started off in affordable housing because he told me, go work in affordable housing. It's the hardest side of the industry. Like, you know, if you can figure out affordable housing, all this other stuff will come like a lot easier to you. So I started off in their acquisition rehab group. We would buy large portfolios of sometimes LP and GP interest. In other cases, we buy fee simple directly from sponsors and execute typically bond credit transactions, renovating them, preserving them long term, extending the HAP contract. And after doing that for about 4 or 5 years, I went back to Steve and was like, this is great, but I'm gonna go get my MBA because I don't want to have any glass ceilings on my head. He's like, an MBA ain't gonna give you like no more access. So he's like, let me start moving you around. So he moved me to what is kind of seen as the premier group at Related at the time, New York Development, and started building new construction projects. And because I had this affordable housing experience, that I spent 5 years, tax credits and bonds and all that fun stuff, Section 8 contracts. I started kind of fitting in very quickly into those
that's
projects.
That's where we met, right? We met at the and then the 100 points south, right?
RFP, F&G. And that's how I met Kurt, because there was a project up in the Bronx that, you know, went up there with Kurt and we were talking about it. And so I got all this great exposure on the affordable housing new construction side and started learning how to build stuff, learn how to design it, get it assembled. And then after, you know, spending, like I said, over a decade of Related, 2020 happened and I said to myself, I need an agency, because what I realized was that the industry did not look like me. The industry was primarily white males. There was a lot of meetings that was happening at that company and at a whole bunch of companies and a lot of panels talking about how do we get more women involved in the industry and how do we get more diversity. And there was all these plans being put together. But when the execution had to happen, you weren't seeing the results that I wanted to see. And so I said, the only way you can change it is you have that agency. You have to be able to make the decisions. You got to be able to hire the minorities yourself and not make a recommendation for someone else. And so then COVID happened and I actually went and sat down with Steven, Jeff and Bruce and said, hey, it's time for me to go. I appreciate it. You guys are phenomenal, but I'm gonna leave. And Steven, again, man of his word, said, you've been great. But like, I want to make sure you're successful. And so I want to be on your board, your advisory board, and Bruce Beal. I want to be on your advisory board. I want to help you. And those two guys have been tremendous. When I started Essence, the first piece of advice Steven gave me was, first thing you need to do is hire an assistant. So when people call you, you don't pick the phone up. You know, you sound a little more important and busier than you are. Somebody else picks the phone up and then says, oh, let me transfer you to Mr. Adams.
That's good. I like that. That's great.
So, and then the other piece of advice he gave me, he said, don't name the company after yourself. He said, because nothing great can be accomplished when you are the focal point, when it's all about you.
So true.
He's like, I named it Related because I didn't want everybody to be thinking, oh, it's just Stephen Ross. He's like, that's how I was able to attract, you know, the Jeff Blaus and the Marty Burgers and the Bruce Beals and the Justin Metz and the you know, they have a phenomenal legacy there because of the fact that like it wasn't about him. And so I followed that. At first, I was going to call the company. It was a Greek word that talks about when Jesus says to Peter that he calls him the rock. Because I was like, it's a great way, real estate company, the rock. How are we going to build it? But the name actually sounds like a foot fungus. I was told a few times. So I was like, one of my buddies had bought Essence magazine. And I said, I like the word Essence because if you're black, you kind of think, oh, it's black. It's kind of cool. If you're not black, you're like, oh, it sounds cool. Like Essence, like, you know. Mm-hmm. And so named it Essence and started in 2021. And we've been at it for the last, you know, 3 years now.
That's a great story. And, you know, everybody has a different path. Kirk and I talk about this all the time. You know, he and I came from different places and different backgrounds and but we've all ended up in the same place, you know, fighting, you know, the same fight. And it's kind of interesting as we do this podcast, you know, we have a variety of different guests. We had, you know, we had Jeff Blau was one of our guests in season three. And so, you know, like they, but they've all arrived in a similar place. It's kind of interesting, right? There's like this group of people that are all trying to do the same thing. And, you know, last season we had Meredith Marshall from BRP on the show. And, you know, he's been such a great success. It's amazing what he's been able to do. And I think he's been doing it for 25 years now, maybe longer. And we talked with him a little bit about like what it was like, but, you know, he's kind of made it sort of past the challenge point. And so one of the things we wanted to just, you know, sort of move into is to talk a little bit about, because you just started a couple years ago, like, what have some of the biggest challenges been? What have been the things that you look at that are not just challenges for any business, but are also, you know, barriers for people of color trying to get into the real estate business and trying to build, you know, build their businesses?
So I'll start with, I think the biggest challenge is money. And I tell my story, single parent household. I remember one time I was in college, I saw my mom's tax return. My mom's tax return that year was $29,000. Mm-hmm. That's how much she made. And so when you do not come from access to capital and wealth,
yeah,
real estate is the absolute hardest business to be in, because unless you're in a situation where someone, you have an equity investor, or you have early partners who are going to own a piece of the business long term, which to me is a little challenging, because it's like, you do all the work, they put up a little bit of money, and forever and a day, they're going to make money off of what you do, but that's the model. But, you know, people of color and people from low income struggle because there is no family member. There's not a mom or a dad you can call on who will put money into an account. So then when you go to banks, they say you got the necessary $2 million of liquidity. And you got, so not only is it $2 million liquidity to actually close a deal, but you got to spend another, you know, $500,000 for the deposits, and then another $500,000 for pre-development. You know, if you just think about that math right there, to complete one deal, you got to have $3 million.
Right. Right.
And so it is the access to capital, which is the most challenging things. And then it's like, it's a little bit of chicken and of egg, right? It's like, you start, everyone, I worked at Related for 10 years, over 10 years. And had experience closing number of projects, large scale projects, working on like very complex deals. And as soon as I go on my own, you know, every bank is like, well, we're not sure you know exactly what you're doing.
Right, 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 right.
And I'm like, I've done these deals 10 times over. Now I don't understand what I'm talking about. I don't know what I'm doing. Right. And so then it's that challenge of the kind of, well, we don't know. We don't think you have the experience. And look, I can't speak exactly for anything, but I will say anecdotally, I've seen colleagues who have branched out from companies, or maybe not even from companies, but have balance sheets because of family or whatever it is, and they happen to not have darker skin or darker hued skin, they don't seem to have the same struggles as I do, of like closing deals with lenders or equity providers. And so capital is the one challenge. I would say the other challenge is just really like when you're putting these deals together, it ultimately becomes problematic because you're always the little guy. And if you live in New York City and you're doing real estate in New York, these are typically larger deals, mm-hmm. right? Small deals in New York are like $30 million deals. And so you end up partnering with people where they're the heavy. They have most of the leverage. And so you end up really battling with org charts. You really battle on operating agreements. You really battle because, you know, a lot of the agreements are not very favorable to you when you look at the face of them. Mm-hmm. And so those are some of the challenges. And I think it all stems from, you know, access to capital, having money, which is
it's funny, you know, Kirk and I, for probably a couple of decades have laughed, you know, when people are like, oh, where'd you get the equity for that? Oh, friends and family. And then Kirk and I are like, well, I don't have any friends and family that have that kind of money to like.
Exactly.
You know? Right. But the other thing, it reversed back to what we said at the opening, you know, of the show about home ownership, because most people in this country, they build wealth through home ownership. And when you look at the home ownership disparity, it becomes really, really stark when you think about, all right, well, so how are people supposed to build wealth if they don't have access to owning their own home? So the capital barrier, you know, is huge, and it's really challenging. And I, you know, there are lots of people in our industry who are really good people and they're doing good stuff. But to use a sports analogy, you know, they were born on third base and they think they hit a triple. And, you know, I mean, right. That doesn't make them bad people. It doesn't make them bad at what they do, but it does make it a stark difference. In how you build a business.
Yeah. And so to that end, I've thought about it a lot that what I have done so far, very, very blessed, have phenomenal relationships. First of all, having relationships with you guys that I can able to call and ask questions, to inquire, to get advice. Like, I mean, that is invaluable. And so I'm blessed the fact that I had that experience related where I can come in contact with people like yourselves and others, Alan Weiner and Matt Wambul, right. I can go on and on and on, to be able to ask people questions and have them advise me, because there are other people who desire to be in real estate and do large projects or work on projects, and they have no relationships at all. And so it becomes very challenging to even, you know, like, I don't know, like process what's happening. But I would say this, what I realized was that like I had certain leverage. I did a whole bunch of projects. I read the RFPs and I would see the RFP said that, you know, 15%, 20%, 25% minority ownership. And I worked on the projects at a large company and I was running the deals, and I realized there were people who didn't even know how many units there were in the building, you know, or how they were going, like what was the infrastructure? What was the superstructure on the project? What was our heating and cooling system and units? And they had 3 times, 4 times ownership that I had in the org chart. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I got to find a way to rectify that. So I leveraged the relationships. I leveraged my relationships with related or, you know, groups like Hudson Companies or, you know, people like yourselves. And it started to give me access to deals with Essence. And what I keep in mind right now is one of my hindrances is lack of, you know, liquidity. Mm-hmm. But if I focus and continue to build, you know, great projects and be very focused minded on building liquidity, so therefore not spending money, right? Like being very wise with my money and my capital. The thing that's most challenging to me now will not be as challenging. Yeah. And so as like the thing that gives me leverage right now won't change, right? Like when you walk into a room and you're bidding on a NYCHA project. And 90% of the residents in NYCHA housing are people of color. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, there's a leverage point there where like I grew up in public housing, right? My first, you know, 5-6 years in life was public housing. Then my mom moved to, you know, affordable housing, and then she bought a house for $49,000. Like, you know I am able to speak to that experience, and I still have family members living in Section 8 housing. Like, I know what it feels like to, you know, to feel voiceless or unheard or, you know, void promises made all the time. And so I feel like I'm able to connect a little bit more to some groups, and therefore, like, maybe that gives us access to deals. And then I have experience to be like, I know how to put these deals together. But the other side of it is I partner with people because I've had those relationships that have the capital. You know, it makes you more resourceful, right? And so I don't want to complain about it too much because it's a part of the journey. It's going to be a part of the thing that helps Essence be special, because we had to, you know, kind of fight up that hill.
So Jamar, you alluded to public housing and the opportunity there. I want to just talk about that for a moment. I always say that diversity is not a favor for women or people of color. When you introduce women and people of color into any industry, whether it be sports or music, they bring something to the table that others don't. And so when you have diversity, it makes the sports world better, the music world better, medicine better, because you have a different perspective, different life experiences that you're bringing to the table to bring the art form or the business or the science to a different level. And so diversity is not a favor for the people who are being included. It makes us all better. And I want to use that as a jumping off point, because one of the big opportunities you've gotten back in 2021 is that Essence was selected to by the New York City Housing Authority to be the lead developer to renovate Fulton Chelsea houses. And I want you to talk to the listener about the process that was followed in order to get you selected there, but talk about what you brought to the table that maybe the other teams didn't, and how that's unfolded at Chelsea Fulton's, because it's shaping up to be a landmark kind of opportunity and development, largely due to your involvement and the leadership you're providing.
So I'll go back right before actually even the designation. So when COVID happened, I started running a lot, and I would run up to I live downtown. I would run all the way up to Time Warner Center and come back. And on my journey up, I would run past these developments between 9th and 10th Avenue, from 16th, 19th, and the other portion was between 25th and 27th Street. And I don't know why, I just kind of got this thought. I was like, man, it'd be great to work on these projects. And then 2021 rolls around, they released, NYCHA released the RFP, and they were like, you know, the residents are actually going to make the decision. You know, first time, you know, your New York City Housing Authority, the residents are going to be making the decision on who the development partner was. And so I thought about it, and we were putting the bid package together. You know, I said, look, this is going to be a big project. You know, it's 18 buildings, 2,056 units, renovation. And it was a whole bunch. It was, you know, like six development parcels that you could build on. And I said, look, I used to work related. Let me reach out to these guys, see if they're interested. And we're like, yeah, they were like, you know, let's go. We're following your lead. And what I realized kind of looking at the presentation package and thinking about going to talk to the residents, because we had to interview with the residents, I realized the experience that I went through. And I would hear my mom and aunts talking about, which was like, again, yeah, you know what I mean? The man comes and tells you, makes you all these promises. They ain't going to do anything. They don't really listen to you. Everybody think they know what's best for you. They come in your neighborhood and tell you what you should be doing. And I tried to flip that on the head. And we went in and said, listen, this is our plan, but candidly speaking, you should take our plan with a grain of salt. What the reality is this: here's our experience and here's our heart, right? Our heart to this is to listen to you and effectively be like a vehicle to deliver to you what you desire, right? And how do we know what you desire? We're gonna meet with you guys. We're gonna set up multiple meetings. So what we did was we created a design and construction group. We created a community engagement and social service group, and we created a management and security group. And so once we were designated, we would meet with like groups of residents to talk about those issues, because I told them, I'll never spend a night in one of those apartments. So why should I be the one picking the kitchen cabinet colors and the flooring? I'm like, I don't live there. You do. So what we did was we had a design firm work with us. We made sure from a cost perspective it worked. We made sure on the management side it was durable materials that wouldn't have to be replaced all the time. And we presented the options to the residents. And we had the design firm present it to the residents. And so they got to engage in that process that was different. And as we were doing it, we were going in and investigating kind of the condition of the buildings, 18 buildings. You know, before we were designated, we got to go and look in like three or four units, and I got stuck in one elevator. So I knew the elevators weren't great. And I think they took us to like five rooftops. So as we were investigating, we realized, you know, and we were doing it in conjunction with NYCHA and with our third party consultants. Wow, they got real bad electrical systems. I mean, these systems are like in horrible conditions. And for us to meet, you know, local law 97, to kind of bring the buildings, heating and cooling and energy efficiency up, we're going to have to like upgrade the electrical panels. And that's a massive cost. Then we start to realize, you know, wow, the plumbing is here is terrible. It's old, it's corroded. Like we're gonna have to change out all the plumbing, 100% of it, vertical and horizontal. Then we start, I mean, it was like compounding. And as it was compounding, because we had the management security, we had the design and construction working group of residents, we were telling them like, hey, and they were concurrent. They were like, yes, I mean, our power goes out in the summer because like too many people putting on AC units in and, it, you know, the power goes out or, you know, they were concurrent. The heat don't work in most of the time. So then they started coming to us saying, because we had planned one new building, they started coming to us asking questions about the new building. Like, why can't we move in that building? Like why? It ain't fair that like you going to just renovate our apartments and you're going to build a new building that other people going to move into our neighborhood in. And it was like, well, the RFP says that we're renovating your apartment, we're building a new building that we can move. Somewhere. And there started to be a kind of a build of residents saying, well, why can't we get new buildings? And, you know, the resident leaders, the TA presidents sat down, well, actually the boards, the TA boards sat down, you know, scheduled a meeting, sat down with me and NYCHA and said, hey, we want to like, why can't we get new apartments? Like, is there a reason we not being offered new apartments in this plan? And so I said, okay, hold on. Let us go and look and see if it's actually possible and let us come back to you. So we went, did the work with architectural firms, came back to them and said, actually, it's possible. And then we went through a process where the resident leaders, NYCHA, and our development team went to meet with elected officials and laid it out to elected officials. And what the resident leader said was, we want to not be the ones that make the decision fully. We want to take this to the residents. And so the elected official says, yes, that's a great idea. So we had a survey process. We did an informational session, 60 days. We would take residents. It was like the part of the business, you know, window of time in my life. We would have 6 days a week, we'd have meetings with residents. I'd have two meetings a day. And on Saturday, we would take them, we would get these buses and take them over to Hunters Point South and Riverwalk Park, two buildings I built, because we had already taken them to a renovation of a NYCHA building. And we wanted to show them, hey, okay, this is what a new building looks like. And we would take them over there and they would walk through there like, we could have something like this, like in our neighborhood. Right. It was like, yes, this is what new buildings look like. And there's ACs and heating and sprinklers and, you know, and they were just amazed. And so they responded to the survey and we had a process where the majority of the residents said they wanted new construction. And we went back to the elected officials and they said, you know, we're going to honor what we said to the residents. We're going to follow this path. And we've been on that path now for, I don't know, coming up now in a year.
So Jamar, talk a little bit about how you think, because I look, the renovation of these buildings takes years. Right. But your current plan, which right is to build, then move people and then tear down and build and move people. Right. I think that's in a very general way what your plan is. How do you keep people, one, engaged and two, sort of believing that progress is being made? Because this is going to take time. Right. There's going to be an extended period in which, you know, some folks are going to be living in the same building they've been living in and they're not going to move. It's not because you can't build a building overnight. So how do you think about that?
So one, going back to the plan, we have a concept called Build First, where we build a new building actually on both campuses and then residents can move into that building. And so the great thing about it is that in large part, they don't even have to like trust us, like just watch the building get built and like, you know, you here's your key, here's your lease, move in.
Yeah.
But how do you keep that trust? Because you're right. There's a loan process, there's an environmental process that has to take place before all that can go. And then we have to, you know, demo the building, right? And then we have to build a new building, right? And then those residents can move from their current, you know, apartment into that new building. What we have to do is we have to keep communicating with them. And it has to be consistent. And it has to be transparent. And then we have to make micro steps. We have to say, here's the plan, but we are hearing you. Residents would talk about the fact that, you know, security is in terrible condition. People get shot, killed, stabbed, homeless people in the lobby and in the stairwells. And so we agreed with the residents that we needed to do something. So we agreed to bring on security concierge on the campus. You know, they were talking about the horrible conditions. Obviously, we saw the conditions of their apartments now. And so with NYCHA, we agreed to, we were going to carve out a certain scope, what we call meanwhile. How do we improve their current conditions in their apartments with NYCHA? So that then, even while they're waiting for the new building, security is better. Their current living conditions are better. And again, we're still meeting with them. We're still having those design and construction. So they're seeing the design progress. They're seeing our plan on management security progress. They're seeing the plan on social services and community engagement progress. And they're seeing the designs. They're like, all right, this is actually happening. And so it is being very purposeful in our communication. And that's not easy. That takes a lot of time. People have different schedules and seniors don't want to come out their apartments at night. And young folks, you know, during the day they work. So it ends up happening where you spend a lot of time, you know, Zoom calls, in-person meetings. But the other part of it to me is making myself available. Every resident, no matter who they are, here's my cell phone number, right? They call me about whatever issues they have because I care about them. And then, you know, some of it is echoing to NYCHA. Hey, guys, we got to work on this. Or some of it is echoing into elected officials. This is problematic. But it's trying to build that rapport of trust. It's trying to build that rapport of openness. And that can only be done by being, you know, by talking to them, like being available. So
Jamar, one of the things that Raphael and I talk a lot about, and we've talked to other guests about this, I think Richie Torres in season one, is the dichotomy between working with residents and people in need on the ground who are experiencing housing crisis and issues, who are really struggling and suffering, and then quite separately dealing with people who are supposed to represent the folks on the ground. I call this group of people gatekeepers. Could be a community organization or activist, could be an elected official or community board. That one of the biggest revelations of Raphael and I and my career has been that when people are struggling, or as a professional, if you've experienced struggling and suffering in your own personal life, that produces pragmatism, where you want to see results and you're not willing to wait forever for results. Whereas the gatekeepers, often people who are supposed to represent poor folks as elected officials, as community boards, so-called activists, they're willing to negotiate 5, 10 years, 15 years, you know, tweak the plan, tweak it some more. There's no urgency. No. And I see some of these dynamic at play with Fulton Chelsea, where when you deal directly with the residents and you earn their trust and you're moving in the right direction that's embraced by them, you know, there's one dynamic. And then somebody who's not impacted in the way, you know, residents are, want to take 5-6 years. They want a different process. And maybe 10-15 years from now, you turn a spade of dirt. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, because it's not only something that I think you see, but we've seen in our careers as well.
Yeah. I mean, it is one of the more challenging things for me professionally, because I started thinking about, I was like, there should be a way for the actual people being impacted to have like something called like hashtag they don't speak for us, where you know, when I walk the site, when I walk into meetings, I have a whole bunch of, like, this is a Black woman, 70 years old, last night came up to me and grabbed me and said, when is this starting? Like, we want this to start like tomorrow. Like, how fast, like the energy of it happening yesterday. It's like so important. And to your point, the people who are, and forgive me, but I can speak my truth. For the people who are not living, the people who are living with heat, with hot water, without mold, who don't have security issues in their building, they have no problem ideating about like the plan. And like, we should talk about it more. We should have meetings and talk, you know, figure this out. And yeah, because again, they're not living in the conditions that they are okay with other people living in for longer periods of time. It's like if you have cancer, right? You want a treatment. You're like, hey, doc, man, what are we going with? Radiation?
Right.
Going with
and
surgery?
I want to start now.
Like, I want something now, right? Because you're the one with the problem, right? And imagine the doctor's like, you know, we want to go and do a research project at like, you know, MIT to determine what the exact right thing is. But this is what happens
in
communities. And it's it's a little problematic, not a little, it's very problematic to me because the people that are impacted the most actually typically have the least have the lowest priority voice on a totem pole. And it shouldn't be that way. It does not make any sense that the person that's impacted the most should have the least amount to say about it. But the way it's set up, it's that way. And so I don't know, like it's we have some great residents who come out and speak forcefully about like, you know, what's going on. They're frustrated. But I will tell you this. Part of my frustration with it typically is that the people who've been negatively impacted are Black and brown people.
Yeah.
The people who are speaking about it and ideating on it are typically not Black and brown people. Right. And so my suggestion has been, and I've stopped saying it, but like I've been in a meeting before and I've said, listen, how about this? You guys want to go and do a 2-year, like, you know, spin up a whole bunch of like community groups and we can talk about it and nothing happens in the current building. That's totally fine. But I want every one of you guys to give like switch apartments. I want you to move into Chelsea and Fulton. I want you to let a resident move out of their apartment into your building. And we can talk about it for as long as you want to talk about it if you want to go that direction. But if you're not willing to make any sort of sacrifice, right, you just get to sit back and talk. I mean, come on, man.
No, I mean, but this is, you know, we could tell stories about this for an hour, but this isn't just about public housing, right? This happens over and over and over again, you know, in neighborhoods that, you know, where affordable housing developments get blocked, you know, because they're too tall or they're too small or they're not the right color or the windows don't look the right way or
Goldilocks syndrome.
You know, it's like there's too much. Let's talk about this and not enough. Let's get this done. It's, you know, it happens at the state legislature, right? We, you know, Kirk and I in this program have talked in this podcast for hours about how we need a new 421A tax incentive so that we can start building housing in New York City because we need that housing now.
Yeah.
Right. And we're just, you know, we're just going to keep talking about it because nobody, you know, has the urgency that 70-year-old woman that grabbed you does, right? Because
I've never been to a public meeting where the plan I was presenting was greeted with like, man, this is great. I go and talk about we're building supportive housing in this neighborhood. Man, we don't want supportive housing in our neighborhood. Like, can you build market rate apartments? I go and say,
right,
hey, we're building mixed income. We got market rate and affordable. Man, we don't want no market rate. Man, can you build all affordable? All right. Now we come in, we build all affordable, not supportive, all affordable. Yo, we need some higher AMI. Like, it's like, listen, guys.
I know. It's true.
When we came to you guys with a plan, we've looked at how you finance this. We understand the subsidies needed. We understand the tax abatements needed. Like, this plan is kind of ready for prime time, right? We've worked on the game plan. We're ready to like start playing the game. And they want to go and like redo the game plan. And it's like, as you were talking, there's people living on the streets right now,
yeah,
right? Be it New Yorkers or migrants or young kids or, I mean, I'm like, guys, go to the homeless shelters. Like,
right,
go to Wynn's. I go spend time at Wynn's homeless shelters and spend time with the kids. Go to one of those Wynn homeless shelters and see how those young people are growing up. And they Wynn has a great program, but like, you
that's
can't tell
for the
me,
listeners, Jamar, that's Women in Need.
Women in Need, wonderful organization run by Chris Quinn. go look at how those young people are living, and they're doing amazing work with those families. But it's not a great existence compared to the fact that they were living in a stable, new affordable housing project, right?
Yeah.
But again, people who are doing most of the talking are not seeing the people who are being impacted, right? Or at least they're not really focusing on them. They're focusing on whatever issues they have. And, you know,
it's really powerful. So let me ask you this question. This is another thing Kirk and I were thinking, we wanted to hear from you, because, you know, we've been talking all about New York City, and, you know, that's where the three of us are. And we could talk for days about it, but you're also doing things in other places, right? You're doing some stuff in the Midwest. You've been looking at stuff in New Jersey. I'm interested in how you see the development process in those places compared to New York. Does this dynamic, is this a New York thing that we're talking about, this dynamic, or is it happen everywhere? And what are the things that, you know, that have jumped out at you about doing development in other places as compared to New York?
I would say you go to New Jersey and you do a development, it is a drastically different process than building in New York City. And you can drive there, right? This is not talking about someone you got to get on a plane and fly. You go to DC, you go to Philly, you go to Chicago. You don't see as much of the of what happens in New York and the challenges that you face in New York to get things built or get things done. Even the accessibility to like the decision makers, and part of the issue is that, like, you know, New York has so much that's happening that, like, you know, wonderful people, and Raphael, you know this, wonderful people at HPD and HTC, right? Yeah. But like, and ACR, but like, there's a little bit of a capacity issue, right? Like, no matter how much they want to do, there's a limited amount of volume cap. There's a limited amount of people who can underwrite these deals. There's just limitations, right? And so in other places, you know, there's not those sort of limitations with volume cap or, you know, 9% credits or even the stress on their staff. They have staffs that are, you know, well suited for the amount of projects they typically complete on an annual basis. And then accessibility with the elected officials. You know, I can go to, you know, I can go to certain places in New Jersey and get a meeting with the mayor of that city, like, fairly quickly.
Right.
And in New York, it's a different dynamic. And so I would say it's much easier to build other places than New York. Obviously, cost wise, it's way cheaper. A unit in certain areas are like fractions of what the cost is to build in New York City. But that's why the old saying is what it is. If you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. I mean, this is the most challenging place to, and I've never built San Francisco or what have you. So I can't speak to that dynamic, but, the places I have built, and I've built a lot of places, New York City is by far the most challenging, you know, and for capital reasons, for construction cost reasons, for NIMBYism, for, you know, agencies being over capacity, for, you know, volume cap being very scarce. New York is a special place.
Mm-hmm. So we're winding down here, but one of the things that I want to finish up with is the topic of mentorship, because real estate, as you mentioned earlier, is a field where, if your parent or grandparent or family is involved in the business, it gives you a leg up. But for people of color and emerging developers of different kinds who do not have family members who are in the business, you know, breaking in can be difficult. And what I've said specifically for developers of color who've had the opportunity to, you know, to launch their business, and is that it's an exercise where you need to lift and climb at the same time. I mean, climb towards your goal, but lift others up, because we are in a community of folks who don't have parents or family in the real estate business. So we got to do for others what someone who wasn't our family member did for us. And so I want you to talk a little bit about that dynamic others have helped you, but I know you do mentorship and, you know, you've been focused on that, not only now, but that's been something that has been meaningful to you for, you know, from your professional athletic days and before.
Absolutely. I mean, mentorship has been something so important to me because, you know, growing up without my dad, my father in my life, I've always sought out particularly male mentors, but I've had all different type of mentors. And it has been the most important thing for me in this business. Again, I can name the list of amazing people who have been mentors to me. You know, Bruce Beal has been phenomenal, big brother. I mean, like we have a current text chain going and like, you know, he's reminding me, little bro, you need to focus on these deals, right? You got to get focused on these. I know the big deals are like the things you want to be in the meetings, but these deals are what keep the lights on. And so, you know, and Steven kind of give me big picture, kind of that vision of saying, look, I know, you know, right now it's hard to make payroll, but, you know, keep going, you know, like, right. That encouragement to understand a 51-year journey for him, it will get better. You got to stay the path. It will get better. And a part of that to me was having been mentored, I feel a very strong obligation to mentor. I've had great people like you, Kurt, right? I call Kurt, I talk to Kurt, like Kurt doesn't owe me anything. Always responds to my phone calls, always responds to my texts. Same with Meredith Marshall, same with Bull Bonetti, right? These black guys who are, you know, climbing and lifting at the same time. And so as you're climbing and lifting and you actually have someone give you a hand up, it feels so odd to not be reaching down to give hands up. And so every young person, one, who I hire, I make sure I'm mentoring them, talking to them about the business, telling them about the importance of like, look, I'm not just giving you a task. Like, this is a part of your growth development process. You know, people who intern with me at Related, people who intern with me at Essence. I mean, I'm proud to say one of my mentors, I mean, my mentees, is just made managing principal at Blackstone. I mean, like, we went out like and celebrated.
That's cool.
Like, you know, and he texted me this morning, was like, hey, bro, you got any concepts on, like, he was talking about like insurance, like how can we, you know, work on reducing, you know, insurance costs across portfolio. I was like, let's have a conversation on that. Mm-hmm. But it is so important because one, I've been poured into so much, I feel I need to pour back. And I get people reaching out to me on LinkedIn or college kids or people at banks who are like, man, I want to transition into the development space, or people at established development companies like, man, how do you get to the place where you're able to start your own company? And I'm pouring into them what has been poured into me, giving them the lessons that were given to me, and then adding my own lessons, you know, like talking to them about, look, one of the first things you should do when you start your own business, get you an accountant so you can get some certified or audited promotion. Because when you are poor and black, okay, like the biggest challenge is going to be everyone going to look at your liquidity, net worth. And so you're going to want to have some certified documents. You're going to want to, because the banks are going to be like, hey, we need to know how much you have. And, you know, that can take some time. And so understanding those things, you know, it's like anything else. If you know what's around the corner, you can prepare for it. And so I'm trying to always give the game to somebody else of what's around the corner. And I have some unique experience as well, because even some people who have been in the industry and run their development company longer than I have, I have the experience of working on some massive projects and being around some of those brains that were at Related, and Richard O'Toole, who's like the greatest tax wizard I've ever seen. And so to be able to kind of, you know, have some good exchange where like there are people who are helping me and giving me some access and information, but I'm also able to give them some information. And then again, having people that I mentor, there's some fair exchange. I ask my questions of them, like, hey, you in DC, I mean, we about to submit for this thing. You know, what's the typical timeline? You know, so there's always that fair exchange. And I ultimately want to create a community, because the reason I started Essence, I did not see a lot of women and black and brown people in real estate. And what I will not be able to do it by myself, right? Bull won't be able to do it by himself. Kurt won't be able to do it by himself. You know, Meredith won't be able to do it by himself. Raphael won't be. We have to have a coalition of us. We have to be a community. Because what's going to happen is, right, and there's some great stories of some great developers we have now. You can get into a situation where your portfolio is underwater. And, you know, I think it's widely known, but there's a great story between Steven and George Perez, where when George was hurting, Steven was able to help George out, right? And so, but that's what happens when you have that community. And so the more people we have on the levels that we are on, and as we keep elevating, the more we're going to be able to help each other. And then also when we start doing RFPs, we're able to say, man, we got that young woman, you know, woman-owned firm. We're going to make sure she's the 10% or 15% partner on this deal. Show her how we do these bigger projects and let her grow her business, right? And so then she one day will look back and say, I got to do the same thing that Kurt and Jamar and Bull did for me. I got to do it for someone else. And so it's setting that standard. And I'm so proud to be able to say, I know both Raphael and Kurt have the ability to reach out to them, ask them questions I ask all the time. And I truly, really appreciate the fact that they openly give me things because they don't owe me anything. But they openly give me knowledge and advice and encouragement, because in this industry, there's some hard days.
Yeah. So it's always been one of the things that, you know, that Kirk and I have talked about that has kept us in this industry and in this business is the people. And it really is about the people. And some days it's really hard. And some days you run into some people that have absolutely no interest in helping you. And they actively, you know, try to hurt you. Mm-hmm. But there's always the people, that are there to help you and that want to help you. And, you know, stay focused on that. And, you can get places, you know, in this world. So Jamar, you're the best, man. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your Friday afternoon to, you know, to spend some time with us and share your story with our listener and, talk housing with us. And, you know, it's a pleasure to have gotten to know you and to see what you're doing. And, you know, keep up the good work, man. Keep killing it. You know, that's all you can do.
So. I appreciate it. And I'll echo real quick what you just said. And I think that's the ethos of Essence, is that I care about people. Yeah. And I care about the people I work with. I care about the people I work for, which are the residents. And I just encourage everyone, when we think about the housing problem, the housing crisis, put people first.
Yeah.
Right? Like, let's put people first. And I think if we do that, a lot of the issues that we face will kind of dissipate. But we have to put people first. Put the care and concern of people at your priority. And then if we do that, again, I think a lot of the barriers and hurdles that we face will start to dissipate.
So. Yeah. No, I hear that.
Absolutely.
Thank you again to Jamar Adams, the founder and managing principal of Essence Development. We really hope that these conversations lead to a greater understanding of the housing problem and the potential solutions. We hope you're enjoying listening to The Housing Problem. I'm Raphael Sestero.
And I'm Kirk Goodrich. You can contact us and find out more about affordable housing in New York City and nationally at thehousingproblem.com.
And please subscribe to and share The Housing Problem, because the more we explore the housing problem, the better chance we have of finding the housing solution.
Produced by Paul Jamali. Executive producers Raphael Sestero, Kirk Goodrich, Eric Biederman, and Tom Corsillo. The Housing Problem podcast is a top content production for Marino PR.
All right, we're out. Now we can sing Hail to the Victors.
Hey, someone sent this to me.
Old school.
That's so good. I love that, man. That's so good.